Hello and welcome to the How to Trade Like a Pro podcast. I'm Wieland Alt, and in this episode, my guest is Julius de Kempener. With Julius, I'm talking about his invention, the relative rotation graph, the RRG, and how you can use it for your trading decisions. Before we start, please take a closer look at the risk disclaimer at the show notes, and now enjoy this episode. I'm here with Julius de Kempener, and with Julius, we know each other for kind of time, like 2 or 3 years, but we just met recently in Jakarta for the IFTA conference, Julius, and I'm very happy that we had a great time together, and I'm also very happy that you agreed to go with me into this podcast interview, like just discussion about live trading and whatever comes to mind. So welcome, Julius. Thank you so much for being with me.
Yeah, thanks for asking me, Wieland. And yes, you're right. We kind of know each other for a couple of years, but we did only meet in real life in Jakarta, because I also think that COVID was a big deal breaker on that one, because we couldn't go to in-person conferences. But yeah, it was good. It was good to meet you. I think we had a great event in Jakarta. That was good fun.
Yeah, exactly. So likewise. Well, let's start right there, because exactly this pandemic, lockdown, a lot of things changed, and a lot of people, they know you, me, or the other ones more from the internet side and are very familiar with going over webinars, online conferences like this, not so much going into in-person conferences right now. Maybe this changes, but how do you feel about the let's say the scene and the people going to conferences before pandemic and right now? How are your experiences, or did you go to any after at all?
I did go to a lot of conferences before COVID. I think the IFTA conference was actually one of the main the main events that helped me get started in my career. First time I went to an IFTA conference was in Dublin, Ireland. I think that was probably in 1990. Yeah. Not sure, either give or take 1 year. And I was completely blue. I had just started. My prior experience was in the Air Force. I was in the military. I came out of the military, started working my first job in the financial world as a portfolio manager. I was, well, not really invited, but like made aware of the IFTA conference by a couple of other technical analysts in the Netherlands that I knew of and I was in touch with. Mm-hmm. and we decided to go to Dublin. And that was my first IFTA. And I think since then, I probably missed 3 or 4, probably less than 5. So that was my go-to event. And I've got to say that it brought me a lot. It brought me a lot of connections, a lot of people that I know, I still am in touch with, even people that are not coming to IFTA conferences anymore for a variety of reasons, I am still in touch with. Yeah. So that was really my most important event that I went to every year. And when that stopped during COVID, that was obviously a bummer. And we started doing all these online events, all of a sudden everybody became very, very good in hosting and participating in online events. Mm-hmm. But now that we can go to in-person events again, I already liked them, but I really like them now because it is so different, you know, going to an online conference and listen. It's way more of a one-way traffic. If it's an online event, there is a presenter and you sit at your own desk and you listen. And that's it. I find it very hard to attend an online event for like a full day. I just can't do that. Your attention gets distracted. You know, there's all kinds of other stuff on your computer going on. You go walk for coffee, blah blah, whatever. And if you're at an event in person, you're kind of stuck in that venue. But you can talk to everybody. And if you're online, I mean, how can you make small talk with the guy next to you in an online event? It's kind of impossible. And to be honest, for me, the most value comes out of these personal connections. I always say that the presenters, the team of the conference, is a very good excuse to go and meet people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I like the presenters. Some subjects I am more interested in than others. Mm-hmm. But the main reason for me to go there is to meet people. I could go to a conference where I don't like any of the talks or any of the subjects and still have a good time.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, sometimes I think people mistake this a bit. Like, yeah, we cannot go, you know, maybe we cannot publish the recordings on YouTube because everything is so secret. But I think it's not really that point. If you go to a conference, you not go just for the information. You go for networking, contacts, having a, you know, having a beer, a nice, and just deepen your relationship to your colleagues, right? So this is basically, from my point of view, what a conference is about and always has been.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the connections that you make are way more valuable than, you know, I mean, think of it like someone calls you up. So someone out of the blue, like you got these cold call marketeers, they call you up and they want whatever they want from you.
Yeah.
How often have you responded positively to one of those? I never did that. I hate
never.
It. It's like, you know, just get a life and get out of my life or do whatever. Right. Where if I'm at a conference, I can run into people that I've never seen before and have a very engaging conversation, and God knows what happens. It's a completely different approach.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I totally agree again. So it's I think really it's what the personal connection, what makes things different, and also what makes it so important to go there. So why are we talking about this? Of course, to encourage every listener to join not just an IMTA conference, of course, but also conferences, going to expos, trade fairs, whatever, and discuss with the people. Because we met there, we got an urge, and it's not so easy to go over just like Messenger, stuff like this, because there's always the risk of some kind of misinterpretation, you know, what do you say? What do I understand? Stuff like this. It's better when you have a beer, we discuss, and, you know, you get there in person. And also what I've heard, like, also big names which appear and show up in this conference where you feel like they are so far away. They're not. They're very easy approach going, right?
No, I have a few anecdotes and personal stories in that respect, because I was like, I had the same when I then back to Dublin 1990. My impression was that, you know, all these big names, they were like on the moon and they were not approachable whatsoever. Yeah. First day I'm at that conference, and at the end of the day, we were standing in a bar, was talking to 40, 45-year-old guy, small, bald, red hair, glasses, had no idea who he was.
Yeah.
Had a very, very, very encouraging, very, very fun debate, interesting. It was John Murphy. He was at that conference, and he was just very approachable. I got very good with Martin Pring at those conferences. Actually, fast forward to 2009, IFTA conference in Chicago, I did my first presentation on RRG to a bigger audience at the IFTA 2009 in Chicago. In the audience was Greg Morris. I knew of Greg Morris, but I didn't know Greg Morris. You know? So after my talk, Greg came to me and asked me, told me, like, congratulations, this is the first time in 25 years someone told me something that is actually new. And we hit it off very good. Greg was a naval aviator. He was a top gun pilot, had a very long career as a Delta captain after that, and ran successfully money using technical analysis. And obviously, everybody knows Greg Morris about the books and his presentations. We emptied the bar at that time, and we had great stories. And I'm in touch. I'm in touch with Greg to this day, and he's actually introduced me to Chip Anderson at Stock Charts. So all of that happened at IFTA conferences.
Yeah. So you just have to go there and, of course, be open-minded to talk and to meet and greet people and just approach, not just you, me, but all the other ones, because that's why we're there for.
Everybody.
We're there to talk, to discuss, right, and just to see other people. Now, let's jump a little bit back, like back to the beginning of the 90s, maybe the 80s, where everything started for you when it comes to trading and investing. Before, you mentioned you've been to the Air Force, to the military, so you have a military background. And first question here, does it help being kind of more disciplined maybe? is it just like, well, it doesn't matter at all?
I think it helps because the military gives you a structured approach to things. They have protocols, they have procedures, they have, you know, ways to address problems or make plans. And I think that obviously not necessarily for trading approaches, but the mindset, the way you think, the way you can like compartmentalize, is that a word? I don't really know if that's a word, but you know, like you can sort of put buckets in little compartments and address that problem without getting distracted by a lot of other stuff. And also the when you're in the military, obviously it's a different situation than a civil life, but if you're in a conflict, you know, sometimes it's life and death, and you got to make split second decisions. And the only way you can make those split second decisions well is when you practice. So you practice and you got the skills and drills, and you're like indoctrinated, if you wish, with certain procedures. And that helps you when such a problem or an event occurs in real life. You don't have to think and remember, hey, what do I need to do? What should I do? You don't have to kind of go through that whole thought process because you've been trained, you've got the skills and drills, and you know, if this happens, then I do that. If that happens, yeah, I do that. If this plan doesn't work, I've got my contingency. So all these approaches, all these military approaches and tactics very much help you with a disciplined approach to structure, to trading and investing.
Mm-hmm. So how did it start for you going into trading and investing? Did you always go with stocks or in investing? Did you do day trading? I mean, back then was not that easy like today, but how did
it start? I'll warn you, I suck at day trading. I'm the worst day trader in the world.
Because you give them your money.
Yeah, course. That's right. So I stopped doing that. I hated myself for that. No, that's totally not my thing. But so when I went to the military academy. So you basically go to, it's like a university type education of 4 years, and it's mixed with military. So you got every year you got military periods where you go out in the field and you do your military exercises, and then the rest of the year you go to school and you take classes, you know, I don't know, math, physics, logistics, yeah, whatever. Mm-hmm. And my study was economics. So I studied economics in the military academy. That's a generic general economic study, but obviously with some military, you know, highlights, you know, your cases would be geared to the military. During that time, I inherited a couple of hundred Royal Dutch shares stocks from an uncle who passed away. So they obviously, I was a share owner. I had no clue, but all of a sudden I had some Royal Dutch stocks in my account, and I started watching that, and nothing happened. You know, it was boring as hell. Nothing happened. Didn't move up, didn't move down, you know, not, at least not in a material way. Also because it was a very small portion, but at, you know, I was 24, 25 probably. But I got interested. And at that time, the Dutch Options Exchange, the European Options Exchange, opened its doors in Amsterdam. And I got interested in that. So I studied that. I studied that whole spiel of options and how it worked and goals and puts and all that kind of stuff. And I actually responded to an ad where an education company was looking for an educator to teach the public what is an option, what is a call, what is a put, what is a spread, what is a straddle, etc. I had just learned all of that and started teaching classes in the evening for that company, basically teaching people what is an option. At the same time, I had to write my thesis to graduate from the military academy. And at that time, the Dutch military was starting to buy F-16 planes in the U.S. And obviously they're priced in U.S. dollars. We were still in guilders. And there is there was a rule, it's probably still there, which dictated that every Dutch governmental body or semi-government, when they were engaging in a foreign purchase, you were required to immediately buy the foreign currency. Now imagine Dutch Air Force is buying, I don't know, we started batches of 25 or 50 planes, and they're not cheap. You know, they're hundreds of millions of dollars. So, yeah. But for this law, we needed to buy hundreds of millions of US dollars. But also, those planes were not delivered the next day. You know, oh. As a matter of fact, not even the next 3 months. I mean, these were long procedures.
Yeah.
So Dutch Air Force was sitting on hundreds of millions of US dollars. And if you remember, we're talking mid-80s, second half of the 80s, and the dollar gilder exchange rate was like going down. I remember dollar gilder trading above 2 guilders, and it went all the way down to 1 something. So these hundreds of millions of dollars were like losing money to no end. And I had my kind of experience in options. And I thought, like, you know, if we could just, we could hedge that. There are instruments with which you can hedge such a position. Mm-hmm. You could buy puts, or you could, if you really need to buy the position, you can buy puts to protect it. Yep. Or you can buy calls with the underlying value, which you can then execute by the time you need those dollars. And if mm-hmm. the dollars are cheaper at that time, you buy them in the market and you just forfeit that call. Or if the dollar is higher, you just exercise your call option. So I thought, that's a very clever idea. I thought I was the smartest man on the planet at the time. So I wrote my thesis on that subject, how the Dutch Air Force could use currency options to hedge their position in US dollars. And obviously that got me way more interested in options trading, and I expanded my relationship with that teaching company, and that the company that I was teaching the class for in my free time was also very much interested in technical analysis. So that's how I picked up technical analysis. They had all the books there and all the stuff. And again, this is second half of the 80s. So I started reading Technical Analysis Explained from Pring. I started reading Technical Analysis of Stock Trends, you know, all the classic books at the time. I started reading them. So basically self-taught myself. Yeah. Then started to work for Equity and Law. That was my first job out of. And then I understood that it was actually a business. There were actually technical analysts out there. And I started, and then I ran into IFTA and everybody else. So that's how I got started, how I sort of floated into the financial world and into fund management.
Yeah, so I understand it just started all out from your own interest, you know, in what is this? How can I be better? How can I not just, you know, like save a lot of dollars for the Dutch government, but also you know how to make money out of this, because if you can save money, you can make money, right? Yeah. So, and then, I mean, that's what you're most recognized for and also most, let's say, famous for is your development of the RRG, which is a relative rotation graph. So how did you came up with that?
Okay, so when I started working in the financial world, first as a fund manager, later as a sell-side analyst, I was working on the trading floor of first of Rabobank International in Utrecht, and later at the floor of Kempen & Co, which is like literally, let me show you, I think that way there in the back, there is the trading floor of Kempen. So I work here in this building for 8 years. And when you're a sell-side analyst, basically my job was to pitch research ideas to institutional investors in Europe. So my universe was European stocks. Stocks 600 at the time, 18 sectors. And I was, you know, just doing my job as an analyst, trying to see which sectors are interesting, which are not, and which stocks to pick. Now, the problem, challenge with institutional fund managers is that they are in the game of outperformance. They need to outperform a benchmark. They are running professional money, some sort of a fund, and they need to beat a benchmark. So they are very interested in which sectors or which stocks are outperforming and which ones are underperforming. Obviously, they do care about the direction of the market, but even if they are 100% sure that the market in general is going down, they have very little opportunity to protect themselves from that, because not a lot of funds allow a fund manager to go into a massive cash position, because that's not what the people who buy the fund buy that fund, because it is a US technology fund or European chemical fund or I don't know, whatever. So if the fund manager is taking the money out and goes to cash, then the guy who buys the funds says, I could do that myself. I don't need a fund manager to hold cash.
True.
Which is true.
Yeah.
So they're in. So, but these guys were my clients, and you know, as you know, if you look at a single graph, we can make some good assessments or whether that security is going up or down. But when you need to compare it at a bigger level, it becomes more problematic. And we do have one metric in the technical analysis toolkit that is very good at that, and that's relative strength, not the RSI, but comparative relative strength, where you compare two securities, so you can compare a sector with the stocks index or a sector with the S&P, and you can say something about that sector. You can say, hey, this sector is doing better than the S&P, but this sector is doing worse than the S&P. Or if you go one level lower, you can look at an individual stock versus a sector index, and you can say this stock is doing better than the sector index. But that's only two securities, and the universe is way bigger. So yeah. When I was working on that trading floor, it's a very competitive world. You really need to, you know, make your entry with these guys, and they're always super busy. So what happened a lot to me, and I told this story many times, is, you know, when you call up this guy and say, hey, I want to talk to you about chemicals or food and beverage in Europe, and I've got a couple of stocks that are interesting. Many, many times I got the response, no, Julius, this week is technology week. Goldman Sachs is having their conference. Morgan Stanley is visiting us with some tech companies. What are your best five stocks in the technology sector? Obviously, you know, if you cover 600 stocks, I didn't prepare for that particular question, so I couldn't answer it. And I realized that I needed something that could, first of all, could answer that question. What are your best five stocks? Or best five sectors, or best whatever. And second of all, I needed to stand out from the crowd. I needed to stand out from the hundreds of analysts that are pitching for the business of this guy. Because remember, these guys are very, very sought after. Like the entire investment banking world, especially at the time, it's changing now. But 10, 15 years ago, the business model was that on a trading floor, you had analysts, you had salespeople, and you had traders. And the analyst writes a report on whatever. The sales guy pitches that report to the fund manager. And he needs to, because that's all for free. You know, all these reports go to everybody. And the bank only makes money when the fund manager says, okay, I like this idea. Buy me 1 million shares of Royal Dutch or sell 500,000 shares of Unilever. That's when the bank, so only when they trade, the bank could sort of write a commission and money started to flow in. So you can imagine how all these analysts, all these salespeople were calling that fund manager because they wanted that trade. And how do you get on the radar of a guy like that? You got to give him something that he doesn't get from someone else. Yeah. And it so it reminds me of a course that we did, because again, I'm a very bad day trader, and I'm probably even a worse salesman. I just hate selling. If someone doesn't want to offer me, I'm like, all right, that's fine. I don't care. I don't push. You know, if you're a real good salesman, you should, you know, keep your foot in the door and keep pushing. And that's just not me.
True. But
I had to go to the course, and it was given by an ex sales guy in the financial world with a very thick Scottish accent, and I didn't pick up a lot, but the one line that I picked up from this guy when we were talking about, you know, how can you set yourself apart, you know, if you write an email, if you write a report, how do you get on the radar of these guys? And what he said was like, you gotta make the fact sizzle. That's like, gotta make the fact sizzle in this really thick Scottish accent. And like, hey, You need to, if you have something that other people don't, you gotta emphasize that. You gotta put that on the forefront, and that stuck with me. And I'm like, what is my fact? What can I do to capture the attention of those guys?
Yeah.
And as I said earlier, it's you know, getting him an answer to his question: what are your best five stocks, what are your best five sixers? But then also, like, for myself, how can I overcome this sometimes narrow-mindedness of the guy that you're talking to? Like, hey, I only want to talk about technology. And that it started with the question, like, what are your best five stocks? That was all based on relative strength. And the problem with classic relative strength is that the numerical value that you get out of that is makes no sense. It depends completely on the numerator and the denominator of your comparison. And you can't compare that through a universe. Now, there are a ton of ways that people do that. And, you know, in the US, for example, what they do is they just look back a fixed period, like 6 months or 12 months, and they say, like, oh, this stock. So they basically anchor it 6 months ago or 3 months ago, and they say, like, right now, that stock is higher than it was 6 months ago. And so it is now outperforming. So the trend is now up. And I thought, like, that's quite late. You know, if you can have a situation like that where you anchor it 6 months ago, stock goes down for 3 months, then starts to move up for another 3 months. It's back at the period, the point where it's 6 months ago, but you've already missed, you know, half of the rally. And yeah. I was like, I want to get in when that trend changes. And obviously those trend changes, they're not fixed. It's, you know, some trends last for 3 months, others 2 months, others 18 months. So I needed something that was way more flexible, but also still comparable across the universe. And that eventually, and again, that didn't happen overnight. It wasn't on Sunday afternoon at the kitchen table. It's something that just grows while you're doing all your stuff. And that eventually became what is now known as the JDKRS ratio. That's an algorithm that looks at an entire universe and makes it comparable. So that allowed me to answer the question, what are your best five stocks? Because I could use it as a ranking mechanism. So I started publishing that in my reports. And this, we're now talking somewhere late 90s, 2000s. Tech boom. You know, everything went up. NASDAQ, 5,000 points, you know, shooting for the stars. And then all of a sudden, it comes crashing down. The stuff starts to move down. And there is obviously, when you look at trends, there's a trend following component in there. So all this stuff needs a little bit of time before it can respond to a market reaction. So in 2000, when the NASDAQ started to come down, I got an email from an Italian hedge fund manager saying, Julius, this time your system didn't work too well. I looked at him. You know, he's right. He's got a point there, you know, because obviously I was super overweight, all these tech stocks, and it was still, you know, it's hunky-dory, everything's good. But meanwhile, the market's coming crashing down. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I need to fix this. I need to do something with this. So that led me to the next phase of development, which was basically to get ahead of the game. And you know that in technical analysis, we have momentum, rate of change. Yeah. That is a leading indicator. You know, before a trend changes, your rate of change changes or your momentum changes. So I started playing around with that, but you run into the same problems that you have with just what I call raw relative strength. The numerical values make no sense. You know, it has to be comparable across the universe. So I went through that same process, same procedure as I had with the RS ratio. And that eventually became JDKRS momentum. So now I had two metrics that I could slice and dice a universe with. And initially, I did that on just in a table, just ranking the numbers. But as you know, we are technical analysts are very visual. We like to look at charts. We like to see how that stuff behaves through history. So I started playing around with graphical formats and just, you know, plotting them just below a regular bar chart and doing all that. And then at some point, I was literally, because all of this stuff, mind you, it wasn't, you couldn't go to Metastock or Stock Charts or Bloomberg or whatever and just say, hey, give me these RS ratio and RS momentum values, because I mean, I made it. So it was one massive spreadsheet that took in data from Bloomberg, did all the calculations with a lot of Visual Basic code in the background. And I always tell people, I could give you the spreadsheet and you still wouldn't know what happened, you know, because it's one of these sheets that are massive. And I know that on that tab, on that cell, I need to change that. And if I do that, then everything else will change there and there and there. Completely just one man show. So, but I started doing that. And I'm at one point, I had those two columns and I selected them and I was in Excel playing around with different graphical formats and I hit on the scatter plot. And then that scatter plot comes up with in my case, 18 dots. Mm-hmm. Looking at it, what's that? What is this? What am I looking at? You know, because it was the first time. So I look at that and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. What am I actually plotting? And, oh, here's that, and that means so you start thinking about that visual that you just created. And that took a while, and it's like, oh, that's very cool. And you could start to understand what's going on, and quite rapidly I thought like, all right, okay, this is now, but I also want to know where is it coming from. So where was that little dot last week or the week before, etc. So again, went back to my spreadsheet, started to doing a lot of VBA code and actually create a series of points. Mm-hmm. So I could then plot the current dot and the previous dot. And I actually figured out how to connect them with a little line and label them. And again, this is 2004, 2005 that I was doing this. It wasn't easy at the time. You needed a lot of code to actually fix that. Right now, it's not too difficult anymore, but you needed to do it. So I figured that all out, and I started publishing that in my report. So I wrote my report, and then at the last page, I had this what is now known as an ORG. I still have the old reports. They look absolutely horrible compared to what it's now. But I started publishing that, and people started responding to it. And one of my clients at the time is Dave Keller. You know Dave well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
sure. At the time, Dave was a managing director of research at Fidelity in Boston, and they were one of the bank's clients. And I was talking to Dave on the technical side. And you know, when you have a relationship, you have this bi-weekly whatever call where you call them up and you talk about the market. So I was talking to Dave at one stage and talking about the market report. And he says, hey, Julius, by the way, that last page of your report, and that, by the way, this was a PDF report that he printed out and read on the train. And he said, I always print that out and I stick it on the wall. I'm like, Dave, why are you doing that? You know, what's the use of that? He said, well, I'll tell you. So he said, when I, you know, over time, I have collected a whole stack of those images. And remember when you were in high school and you had your notebook and you were bored and you started to draw that little puppet on the bottom of your notebook?
Yeah.
You know, little round with a, you know, a body and then two lines that are the legs and two arms that are the two lines that are the arms. And then on the next page, you draw the same little image, but then the arms are, you know, a little bit different, and the legs are a little bit different. Then you do it again on the next page and the next page. Uh-huh. And the next page. And then at the end of the class, you could pick up your stack of paper in a notebook, and then the little puppet started to walk across the bottom of your notebook. And that was what Dave was doing with that stack of graphs. He was like, and he could see the rotation of those little dots. And that was when it really started to come to life, that there was a rotational pattern involved and that we could actually make that dynamic.
Mm.
And that's when things really started to accelerate with that realization. Hey, this stuff rotates. It rotates around the benchmark and it rotates clockwise. And that was a real big aha moment, that like everybody's always talking about sector rotation, but markets actually do rotate, but nobody was ever able to visualize that sector rotation. Everybody who was talking about sector rotation was showing you these sine waves, and they were saying like, oh, the sector is right here, it's the top of the cycle, and it goes down, and it's underperforming, etc. So we're rotating through sectors. When we had that first image of an ROG, we could actually say like, hey, this is rotating around the benchmark. So that is how that started to come to life, and that was the start of RRG as we know it right now.
Yeah. Wow, Julius. I mean, it's so cool to listen to your story, how you developed it. And it gives me, and I'm pretty sure all the other ones listening to this right now, as well, a very, very good image on how things progress. And just to make one thing clear, we take things we find in our charts for granted, like, oh, here's a Bollinger Band. Oh, here's the RRG. Here's this and that. But we never think about how came this thing to life? How came somebody up with exactly this one, which is very useful and helpful? And if we use it the right way, can bring us a lot of money. and also can save us a lot of pain, fear, anger, and whatever, you know. So I really appreciate that. What also you describe the way you went through it, and also it gives me the idea that sometimes it needs also the view from the outside, like what you experienced with Dave, that you know that you can follow your idea a little bit more and a little more deeper, and have another point of view on this. So it's amazing.
Yeah, you gotta keep an open mind, and you gotta, you know, sometimes you need to think out of the box. Right. You know, that is just if you keep running around in circles, you keep getting the same stuff. It's a saying, you know, if you keep doing what you've been doing, you keep getting what you always got. So if you want to change something, you need to change your behavior, or in our business, you need to change the way you look at things, the way you approach things.
Yeah. So how, in a nutshell, how can I read the RRG? So, I mean, you have these four quadrants, like leading, weakening, improving, lagging. So how to read it?
Well, I mean, so on the horizontal scale is the JDK errors ratio. That is a metric of relative strength. That gives you, it's a metric of trends in relative strength. That's a big difference. So it tells you whether the relative trend is up or down and how strong it is, because something with a higher RS ratio is in a stronger uptrend than something with a lower RS ratio. That's the first thing. That was my first metric that, you know, before RRG even was alive, that was already there. Then on the vertical scale is the JDKRS momentum. That momentum is a normalized metric to measure the rate of change in those trends. So it tells you what the speed of that trend is doing, whether it's accelerating or decelerating or leveling off. Mm-hmm. So when you, and now this is, it's quite funny, I've done this a few times before, but in a podcast, which is audio only, describing a very visual tool. Yeah. But so I'm gonna appeal to the listener's image and fantasy to paint that image in your head. So you've got a scatter plot with four quadrants. In the top right quadrant, that's the leading quadrant, whatever shows up there is in a relative uptrend versus the benchmark, which is the center of the chart. So where the two axes cross, that's where the benchmark of the chart is. If you're in the top right quadrant, you're in a relative uptrend versus the benchmark, and that uptrend is still being pushed higher by strong momentum. That's the first thing. So that's where you really want to be. That's the good stuff. It's outperforming the market, and the outperformance is still growing. When you see that loss of momentum, it moves into that weakening quadrant. It still means that you are in a relative uptrend, but that trend is just losing strength. When that loss of strength continues, eventually that trend will turn around and move into a relative downtrend. And that's when you move into the lagging quadrant. And what you find there are sectors or stocks that are in a relative downtrend versus the benchmark. And that downtrend is being pushed further down by negative momentum. So that's what you really want to avoid. But then, just like on the opposite side, the first thing that will happen is that your momentum, your rate of change will start to pick up again and send the tail back up towards the improving curve. And when that happens, you're still in a relative downtrend. But that downtrend is getting less strong. It's starting to pick up. It's starting to prepare for a turn. And then it moves into improving. And if that improvement continues, you will eventually go back to the leading quadrant again. And then you have a full circle. You have completed a full rotation around the benchmark.
Yeah.
Because of the way the metrics work, you can always say that something that is higher on the RS ratio is stronger than something that is lower on the RS ratio, but also something that is higher on the RS momentum scale is moving faster than something that is lower on the RS momentum scale. And then there's, you know, over the years we picked up a whole lot of observations and stuff that help you understand that rotation way more and way better. Quite a few interesting things that we discovered, but this is the basic interpretation on how you go full cycle in this rotation pattern.
Yeah. So this means, you know, when I'm looking at a certain, let's keep it to source. So when I'm looking at a certain stock and I'm not just going over with selling or buy, let's say buying a breakout, I'm more into the buying the dip. So I could use this, like, let's say I have a dip and it's happening in the leading area. So this is like a confirmation for me to really be confident that this buying the dip is quite a good idea. Do I get it right?
Yeah, the only thing is that you really need to be aware of the fact that it's all based on relative strength. So it is very well possible that a sector or a stock ends up in the leading quadrant, but still going down in terms of price. Because what you will have is that the market is going down. This stock is just not going down as fast as the market. This is for the portfolio managers who are in the game of outperforming. The market lost 10%. You as a fund manager lost only 5%. You're a king because you outperformed the market by 5%, but you still lost 5% of the fund's value. That is something that is really important to understand, that it's all based on relatives. So even if the market goes down, you will still see stuff ending up inside the leading quadrant because they're going down less fast than the moon.
I see.
To your question on how to interpret, like, buy the dip, I always tell people that you should use RRGs in a similar way as you use price curves. Also, like, I think the most asked question after RRGs were launched is, what are the trading rules and what is the track record? And I counter that by saying, what are your trading rules on the bar chart and what is the track record of the bar chart? There isn't. It depends completely on who reads it. What is your horizon? How do you do that? Some people trade 5-day breakouts. Other people, you know, trade 20-day breakouts. Some people are looking for basing from it. There's 100 different ways on how you can read a chart. It's the same with an RRG. How aggressive are you? How conservative are you? What is your goal? What's your horizon? But the one thing that I want to point out is, just like you, like, buy the dip, the way I would buy the dip using regular charts is basically taking a weekly chart, make up my mind on what's happening on that weekly chart, say, hey, this is an uptrend, I'm interested to participate. What will I do? I'm looking for sell signals on the daily chart that go against my primary trend, sit that out, and when I get a new buy signal or a new situation on my lower time frame chart, I jump in the bigger trend that's on the weekly. We can do the same with an RRG. So RRGs you can do on monthly, weekly, daily, hourly, 10 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever. It's exactly the same as a price chart.
Yeah.
Also, just like when you on a price chart, you would take away the price axis and the time axis, you wouldn't be able to tell what the time frame of that security is. Same with an RRG. I'll take away the price and time stuff. You won't be able to tell if you're looking at a 5-minute RRG or monthly RRG.
Yeah.
So what I would do is on the weekly, look for probably stuff that's just moving out of lagging into improving, starting to move towards leading, because we've learned that the heading, the RRG heading, is very important. That's the angle from the last observation to the current observation, and you got to think in terms of compass in a plane or a boat. It has to be between 0 and 90 degrees. What that means is that that thing is moving up on both scales. It's moving up on the RS momentum scale, moving up on the RS ratio scale. So that's good. If you see that kind of a situation on a weekly, and you detect a situation on your daily RRG where it is rotating from leading into weakening, that's when I become alert. That's when I'm starting to look for that daily tail to start hooking back up. And that can happen either inside the weakening quadrant or either inside the lagging quadrant. So imagine that tail coming down, and it doesn't really matter whether it's in weakening or in lagging. Weakening is better, but lagging is also. When it starts to move up and pick up strength and both axes that turn into that 0 to 90 degree heading, that's my time to buy the dip, because I know that the weekly tail is still stronger and a good heading, and that daily tail is now just turning back into that same direction. So I got a synchronized move on both time frames, and that's what you're looking for.
Nice. Yeah. And again, I think for me, it always sounds like a little bit, okay, you need some filter, you need some confirmation. just to, you know, to make sure that you have the right timing, and that's what techno analysis is about, timing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically the idea. And I think also it's for going short should be the exact opposite, like, you know, going from lagging to, well, it just goes
it goes clockwise, yeah. So yeah. From weakening to lagging, yeah. or from leading into weakening if you're very aggressive. By the way, there's an interesting story about shorting and in relation to RRG, because when this started to come to life, I was writing my reports, like, yeah, what is the performance, what is the track record? At one stage, I had an intern on the desk, and I asked him, go back to pick up all the reports that I've written. We had a good four years of reports. They were monthly reports. And look at all the recommendations that I made. And my recommendations were very simple. They could be outperform, neutral, or underperform. That was it. Mm-hmm. That was the only three things that I could say. And see what the performance has been of those recommendations. So that's what we did. It comes back and says, oh, good news. The performance of the overall list is significantly better than the benchmark. Nice. But it was only 4 years, so like a good 50 observations for every sector. Not really a lot, not really reliable, but also there was a subjective call for me, because I would look at the RRG and I would make the call whether it's, you know, outperform, neutral, or underperform. There was some sort of a rule set that I was using, but I was the one finally making the call. And you know, if I would look at something that would look really good at an RRG, but I was seeing that it was just pushing against resistance, I would wait until the price would break resistance before making the call.
Yeah.
So in order to get more history, and stocks has history going back to early 80s, I think, a lot more than what we had at the time. And so we kind of took the rules that we had, quote unquote, and made them into real rules, hard rules. And that same student went back and took all the history and applied only the rules, but over a long, much longer period of history. Comes back and says, good news, it's holding up, still significantly outperforming the benchmark, but not as strongly as the 4 year period. And I said, well, that's nice, because it means that I add value to the process, or maybe it was the shorter or the less data points that we had. Mm-hmm. But then he did something that triggered me, and I still use that today. And what he did is he took all the recommendations of all those sectors of all those years, and he listed them by outperform, neutral, underperform, and he calculated the excess returns for those various recommendations. And what he found out is that the excess return of my underperform, or the system's underperformance recommendations, was way higher than the excess return of the outperformance recommendations. And now that is interesting. And think about it. Every investor, every portfolio manager, at the end of the year, looks back.
Yeah.
They can identify, and it's the same for you, where you can pinpoint 3, 4, maybe 5 bleeding trades of which you think, God, I wish I would have been able to avoid those. It would have helped me so much. Everybody has them.
Of course.
Still, we only focus on the upside. The question that I got was, where should I be invested? What are the best 5 stocks? What are the best 5 sectors? And with this research in my hand, I started telling to these people, like, dude, you're asking me the wrong question. You should not ask me where you should invest. You should ask me where should I not invest, because that's a way more important decision than where I have to invest. And also think about it in terms of risk. Something simple like the Dow Jones 30. If you buy all 30 Dow stocks in the correct weightings, you will get the Dow 30, right?
Somehow, yeah.
So what people do, they focus on the top 5. So they want to buy 5 stocks out of the Dow 30 to beat the Dow Jones Industries. That's quite a bit of risk, because you're putting all your faith in those 5 stocks.
True.
If you're right, you beat it. But if you're wrong, you go down.
Yeah.
Turn it around. Take the same 30 Dow stocks and avoid the bottom 5. So buy 25 out of 30 Dow stocks and avoid the 5 that are really underperforming. Guarantee you will outperform the Dow, because you don't own the bleeders of the Dow. but your risk is way lower because your risk is now spread out of 25 stocks instead of 5 stocks. Granted, the volatility, the generated alpha will be a lot lower, mm-hmm. but your risk-adjusted returns, especially if you're a professional investor and running a big portfolio, possibly could impact it.
Yeah, I love it. What not to buy is exactly the question everybody has to answer. It's like life.
Yeah.
Who not to approach? You know?
Exactly. Yeah, the guy with the gun.
Yeah, what not to eat, what not to consume, you know?
Exactly. So, yeah, you're right.
What not to do.
Yeah.
It makes life easier. If you follow just these questions, it makes easier because you can choose a lot except these, you know? I love it.
Yeah, the toxic stuff, the bad stuff, whatever. You give it a name. Whatever. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So how is RRG used most for? Like intraday, I think not so much, but more like really in the long term or midterm.
So obviously, initially, it was my client base, which were institutional investors. They, by definition, have a longer term investment horizon. So mm-hmm. my time frame is the weekly chart, the weekly RRG, which I still use most of the time. Mm-hmm. But when it became more popular, you're appealing to a broader group of investors, a broader group of traders, and we added a lot more stuff, and also intraday movement, and at stock charts, which is one of the most important implementations. People are now able to use it on an intraday basis, so mm-hmm. these stocks, but also if they Forex and whatever data points there are available in real time. Optima software is one of the strongest implementations of RRG. You can connect that to professional data services like Bloomberg, but also IQ Investing. Some of the data vendors that provide with intraday data. So if you're connected to a data vendor that provides you with intraday data, you can render an intraday RRG. So you have to have access to a system with intraday data and an RRG implementation. And that is where we're still working on. We're looking to expand the number of platforms that provide RRGs. So we're always willing to discuss on implementing RRGs on that platform and do it in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we are. That's what I'm currently focusing on most, to work with data vendors, websites.
Yeah.
Investment software, portals, whoever, to get them to implement RRG.
Yeah, perfect. And all of a sudden, Julius, you're into sales as well.
Yeah.
Just a final word, because I'm just looking at the clock. We're almost
an hour. Time flies.
Yes. So one question comes into mind. As a system like this, where you worked on for years and had so much, you know, like things to figure out, do you think you will ever stop evolving it, or will there be a time when we think like, okay, this is now, right now, RRG is perfect and please don't touch it anymore?
Nothing is perfect. The world evolves, the data sets evolve. I still believe that we are way smaller than AI. So I believe that, you know, whatever is in my head, the creativity, human creativity will still and always be a very crucial part of what we do. Mm-hmm. You can use AI to speed up stuff and make mm-hmm. things easier, but in the end of the day, AI is trained on stuff that people made up.
Exactly.
You know? So I don't see a world where AI will get creative, because it has it's trained on a limited data set. So only when you expand the data set, then you can expand the capabilities of AI, but it needs a human brain to actually, you know, come up with that. And to give you an idea, stuff that I'm currently working on with RRG, and some of it is already in production and in play at some places. Well, we work with, for example, the classic RRG has the dots and the connections. That's the tail. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we started doing is, instead of dots, using bubbles. You know, these bubble charts where size changes over time. We started doing that with the weight of a sector within an index, because you know that technology is a big sector, discretionary is a big sector, but yeah. energy and utilities are way small. So we can now create RRGs with bubbles that mm-hmm. indicate how big of a sector, how big the weight of a sector is in the universe. That's very, very visually interesting to see, because it gives you an immediate sense of where they, which parts of the market are moving. The next step that we did is, instead of taking the weight of a sector or a stock in a benchmark, is connected to a client's portfolio. So imagine you're an asset manager, you're a registered investment advisor, you're a fund manager.
Yeah.
You have your portfolio. Your portfolio is stored either in Bloomberg, Reuters, some system. But you can create a list with the weights of your positions.
Mm-hmm.
And we can then connect that to an RRG. So with these bubbles, we can show a client. So an RIAs are now using that in their reporting, because these reports are always super boring. They're like a table, and you bought it at this price. It's now worth this, and it's so much worth of your portfolio. Imagine that you can convert that table into an RRG with bubbles, and it shows the client exactly which his heavyweight holdings are and how they are behaving to the benchmark of his portfolio.
Right.
That's one thing that we do. I'm working on volatility adjusted, some securities are way more volatile than others. Bringing in some sort of volatility adjustment, or again with the bubbles, show which ones are more volatile than others. So you get, as a user, you get a sense of like, hey, this is volatile stuff. So my stops should probably be closer than the ones with a low volatility, where I can allow for a little bit lower stop because it doesn't change that much, that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. I like seasonality a lot. I do a lot with seasonality. And I'm now working on a project where I am going to calculate seasonal performances for, I'm doing it on sectors right now, because that's it's a huge amount of data. But if I figure it out and we can program it, we can do it for everything. Yeah. So imagine taking 20 years of data for a sector, and then instead of doing it on a monthly basis, doing it on a daily basis, calculate the daily changes throughout the year and make a seasonal pattern out of that. So instead of doing it just like, oh, this month is better than usually, you do it on a daily basis, so you can actually render a seasonal pattern throughout the year on a daily scale for a sector.
Mm-hmm.
When I have that and I'm able to align that with the current value of a sector on the RRG, if I have the outlook, I can calculate, based on the seasonal assumption, the forward-looking RRG, so the forward-looking tail for that sector. And then I'll be able to plot an RRG with current position of the tail and the outlook for the next month, 2 months, 3 months, based on its seasonal pattern, assuming that seasonality will work out. That is where that tail is going. So you got a forward-looking tail on the RRG, that kind of stuff, and a gazillion more.
Well, sounds exciting, and I'm really happy to hear that there's a lot of more to come. And also, it also shows that once you're into a process of developing and thinking about how to feel and see and follow the breath of the market, it never stops.
Hmm.
There's always something you can add, always something you can discover. And this is also like kind of message to the listeners. It's, of course you can go for a weekend course on trading, watch a YouTube video, but if you want to really be professional, you have to be dedicated to it. That's what I feel about you as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You got to be dedicated. You got to continue to evolve and never take anything for granted. And I love RRG. I developed it. I think it's a great tool. But I always tell listeners and investors, like, it's not the only tool. Just you got to combine it. So at the end of the day, you need to, whatever you look at on an RRG, you need to look at a price chart and make a decision. It's the combination of tools that will help you get ahead. And RRG is your high level overview. It points you to the right directions of the market, where you should be or should not be. And but in the end of the day, you need a price chart or a price, because like Brian Shannon says, you know, price pays, only price pays. That's true. I mean, you can't buy an RSI, you can't buy a MACD, but you also can't buy an ROG. You need to buy price. That's the
point. These are tools. Tools exactly. Helping us making a better decision. And as you stated, what not to buy. And that's the best decision ever. Yeah,
exactly.
Julius, wonderful. Thank you so much for your insights and for, you know, sharing all your wisdom with me, with us, with the audience. And I'm really looking forward to meeting you next. This will be in China.
China, yeah. Look, I heard it.
So let's see how this works out. And yeah, hope to see you there and maybe talk soon as well. So all the best.
Absolutely. Let's do that. And you have safe travels because you're all over the place.
That's already it. And I really hope that you enjoyed this episode and you took away some learnings for your personal trading. If you want to learn more about me, about my interview partners, if you want to have a one-on-one coaching or even get into a training course with me or my interview partners, just get into the show notes and follow one of all these links you find there. And then I will be happy to hear and see you again. Your Wieland.